Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Sean, you don't sound too good.
I know, I never sound good.
No.
And it's not the mic. Not the mic.
I have to have you on, so whatever.
part of the contract.
All right. Ready?
We're ready.
All right.
Marco, so, you look like you're hovering over something there.
I am a drone.
Look at me. Drone.
You're
a
Iron drone. Man. Like.
I'm Iron Man. I am Iron Man. No, I'm not. Not at all. I'm not a risk taker.
Well, my background, for those looking at the screen, is the high desert, and I'm actually even up in the mountains at the moment at about 8,000 feet, so even higher in the high desert, technically mountains, I guess, but it's nothing compared to the heights that our guest has been to.
Ah, yeah, right? It's going to be to a different level, literally.
Different level, and this conversation, these conversations are all about that, bringing life to a different level, connecting cyber.
And bringing also people to a different level. So again, for those that are watching the webcast, they already know who's on.
That's right.
For those that are listening, then we can teasing a little bit. And it's an unusual gathering where we bring people and have conversation about things that sometimes may sound like they're not well connected, but you know what, in the end, everything is connected. Everything is connected with technology. Everything is connected with society, policy, and the way we live our life. And one thing that we do here, Sean, is that we started this tradition that we have a guest, and then what?
And then that guest gets to be a co-host.
If we like it.
Yes, and it's an even higher bar than if we like them. But we were fortunate enough to meet Teresa Payton, who is our co-host today, through our good friend Ted Harrington. And of course, we love Teresa and all the things that she's doing. And we said, please join us and
bring a friend.
Bring a friend, and she brought an amazing friend, if I have to say. So, Teresa, can you introduce who you brought with you?
Okay, so first of all, you're not telling the full story there. You said bring one of your badass friends.
I did say badass friend, yes.
So
we use the word badass a lot.
You did.
And, that's very true.
And naturally, I thought of my good friend, Allison. And I want to tell her, she's got so many accomplishments, it's amazing. But before I get into like her professional bio, which I'm going to do because, I need to do her justice, but she's also a great personal friend. We both speak at Kepler's Speakers Bureau. She has come to my house. She's had froyo with my kids. When my son was going through the college decision process, she wrote him an email with some different ideas. And she's just all around an amazing woman. I'm so blessed that when I went out to RSA the end of February, San Francisco, she and her husband, Pat, and her two dogs, Scout and Trooper, actually came into the city to have dinner with me. And I'm so thankful, Allison, because I don't know when we're going to get a chance to be together again due to COVID-19. But
I know we hit the timing was so perfect. It was so perfect because right before lockdown in the Bay Area. So I'm also feel very thankful we got to see each other before, you know, everything crashed.
And we had a delicious Italian meal sitting outside on the sidewalk with the dogs. It was so good.
Very good. Yeah, right, that was one of our last conference. Oh, it was our last conference too. Yeah. And then we came back home and locked down since.
So like we shot through the other side of the vortex on that one, and that was it.
Yeah, but here we are.
Here we are.
Still together, even if far apart.
Well, let me tell you too, besides the fact she's my friend and she's just an incredibly cool person, probably one of the most cool
badass.
Let me tell you a little bit about why I thought it would be so great for people to hear from Allison today. So first of all, it's COVID-19 and there's wildfires going on the West Coast. There's earthquakes, there's hurricanes. It's a really challenging time for so many of us. And Allison has a proven leadership style to not just survive during extreme difficult situations, but to actually thrive. And she's done it in the world's toughest places. She was the team captain of the first American women's Everest expedition. She has scaled the seven summits, and she hasn't just done the North Pole. She's done the North and the South Pole. And just has been a breaker of the glass ceiling, doesn't see a glass ceiling, and a trailblazer all along the way. Besides scaling mountains, she first of all started scaling the corporate ladder, worked on Wall Street. She has her master's, her MBA from Duke University. She has a book that I recommend everybody get called On the Edge, Leadership Lessons from Everest and Other Extreme Environments. If you don't think this is an extreme environment, I wanna know your secret to success for Zen, okay? So what's great about that is she takes these amazing lessons that she learned leading these teams in these extreme situations, and she translates them into what we all need for both our personal and professional lives. She's also previously been an adjunct professor at West Point. So she's helped, you know, kind of our US military's best and brightest as they're getting ready to go into active or reserve duty, think about how to leverage leadership. She also, in 2019, is a recipient of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor. And that's not something like, you know, they don't just give out, you know, these awards just to anybody. It's because of her accomplishments in the field and inspiring national service. And so it's really cool. It's recognized by the Hill as one of our nation's most prestigious awards. And I can't think of anybody better than Allison to have that. And it's in the congressional record. So she's in the congressional record, not because she's a criminal, but because she won that award. And as I mentioned before, she's married to an amazing man who's also served our country well, Pat, and she's dog mom to Scout and Trooper. So Allison, thanks for joining us.
Oh my gosh, what an introduction. Thank you, Teresa. You've been such a great friend over the years. I feel like you need to be my publicist with all like how well you did at that. I'm like, I might have to hire you.
I'm sold.
I'm happy to do your intro videos, Allison. You could just be
please.
Like, before I tell you about myself, here, listen to my
Perfect, perfect. Well, thanks for hitting on so many different things. And I agree, we are in, you know, an extreme environment today for sure. You know, we don't know what next year is going to look like. We don't know what next month is going to look like. We don't know what, you know, next week's going to look like. We don't really even know what tomorrow is going to look like. But, you know, you don't have to know what tomorrow is going to look like. You just have to know that you can get through each day, right? Day by day. And so I feel like if you just focus on putting one foot in front of the other, when you think about these big overwhelming tasks, and right now everything feels overwhelming, COVID, the fires, the economy, the elections, just everything is coming at us so fast. And it feels a little bit out of control, I think, for a lot of people. But what you have to remember is that, you know, we're all climbing this mountain together, right? It's like we're climbing a big mountain. And what I want people to remember is that you don't have to be the best, fastest, strongest climber to get to the top of the mountain, right? You just have to be relentless about putting one foot in front of the other. And that is how we're going to get through everything that we're facing right now, just one step at a time. Don't let things overwhelm you. Break big tasks down into smaller parts. And I think they're so much easier to tackle that way. And getting to the top of Mount Everest is just one step, right? One step, thousands of times, granted, but everyone can take one step, right? Everyone can take one step. And every time you take one step, you're moving closer to the top of the mountain.
Thank you. I think that's really, really cool advice. I know you had setbacks, and it doesn't have to be about Everest. It could be North Pole, South Pole, seven summits. Yeah. But talk a little bit about, you know, because I think that's what a lot of people are dealing with right now is like, this is not how I think any of us imagined 2020 was going to be for whatever right. reason. Maybe you have a graduate in your life. Maybe you've got somebody in kind of a nursing home in your life. I mean, whatever it is, a lot of people, this feels like a big, huge setback. Like yeah. how do you kind of mentally like kind of pick yourself back up?
Sure. So I've got a great analogy for that, which is actually the way that you climb Mount Everest. So many people think that you climb Mount Everest, you know, you get to base camp and then you climb to camp one, climb to camp two, climb to camp three, right? You just make your way slowly up the mountain until you get to the top. But that is actually not how you climb Mount Everest. It's going to take you, you know, 2 weeks or so of hiking just to get yourself to base camp. And once you get to base camp, you have to spend a few days in nice air to get used to the altitude because it's over 17,000 feet. So once you've been there for a few days, then you pack up your stuff and you move up to camp one. You spend the night up at camp one. And then after you spend the night at camp one, it's about 20,000 feet. You pack up your stuff and you actually come back down to base camp again. Then you spend a few nights at base camp again, and then you climb up to camp one again. Then the next day you pack up your stuff, you climb to camp two. It's over 21,000 feet. Spend the night at camp two, and the next day after you spend the night up there, you pack up your stuff again, and you come all the way back down to base camp again. Spend a few nights at base camp again. Next day, climb to camp one again, spend the night. Next day, pack up your stuff, climb up to camp two again, spend the night there. Next day, you're gonna spend could be 9 or 10 hours fighting your way up the mountain to get to camp three. You're at almost 24,000 feet at that point. And the next day you pack up your stuff and you come back down to base camp again, all the way back down to that base camp. And the reason you have to keep coming back down to base camp is because you have to let your body get used to the altitude very slowly. It's this process called acclimatization. So if someone were to drop you off on the summit of Mount Everest, if you could be dropped up there automatically by a plane or a helicopter or something like that, you'd be dead in a matter of minutes from the altitude. So you have to move up the mountain really slowly just so your head doesn't, you know, pop off when you get to the very top. I mean, and it doesn't really like pop off. But the catch is that anytime you're above about 17,000 feet, or sorry, anytime you're above about 18,000 feet, which is going to be any camp above base camp on Mount Everest, anytime you're above 18,000 feet, your body is starting to deteriorate and your muscles are getting weaker. So it's this crazy catch 22 of wanting to spend time up high, you know, to get used to the altitude, but you have to keep coming back down lower on the mountain in order to, you know, regain some strength. You can, when you're at the lower elevation, that's when you can sleep better, you can eat, you can hydrate and regain some strength and let your muscles recover when you're lower on the mountain. So the, you know, it's just this crazy thing of wanting to spend time up high, but you have to keep coming back down low. But what you have to remember is that even though you are going back down the mountain in what feels like the wrong direction, you are still making progress because you're helping your body acclimatize. And for whatever reason, people tend to think that progress has to happen in one particular direction, right? We tend to think that progress typically is kind of linear, but that's not the case. Sometimes you are going to have to go backwards for a bit in order to eventually get to where you want to be. So I don't want people to look at this time, like when we feel like we're backtracking or going backwards, I do not want people to look at that as losing ground. I want everyone to look at this as a time to regroup, regain some strength, so we are better out of the gates the next time around. And I have a phrase that I've actually trademarked, but it's that backing up is not the same as backing down, right? Backing up is not the same as backing down. Backing up can make you stronger, right? It doesn't mean defeat. So that's what we have to remember right now is backing up is not defeat. Backing up is an opportunity to regain strength.
This is incredible. I have a comment immediately. First of all, I have to say I've watched many documentary about climbing, I never heard this side of the story.
No one talks
because
about
that. Because they make you look like, oh, here you go. We're going to, you know, backpack up the mountain. And the faster you go, the better it is. Because, you know, you want to get it done and get out of it. So this is incredible. But it's also an incredible lesson for anybody that just think that things are easy. I mean, we know people train really hard.
Right.
It's overnight success. It takes a lot of work.
And it's so hard because especially when you're at Camp 3, 24,000 feet, right? And you're thinking, oh, the summit, you know, I just have one more camp and then the summit. The summit's 5,000 feet up. Base camp is more than 6,000 feet down. Why do I want to go? I have to go down and then do this all over again. And it's really easy just to think I can't do it. And that's why a lot of people, when they come back down to base camp, they just think, oh, you know, and you come back down to base camp and it's so much more comfortable because you're at a lower elevation. So you can breathe more easily. You can sleep more easily. You have your own tent, you know, you get a little privacy. And a lot of people just think, I don't know if I can get back up there again. Maybe this is it for me. And a lot of people come back down to base camp and they feel so comfortable that they just say, I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to go up there. It's just too uncomfortable. But we all have to embrace discomfort if we want to grow, right? If we want to push ourselves and really get outside of our comfort zone, a lot of that involves embracing discomfort.
And that applies to business, right?
For sure, yeah.
And talk to me about the balance of discomfort versus the reward. I mean, clearly, you want to get to the top. You want to experience it. Can you actually experience the greatness of it with all the pain that you I'm assuming you had had to experience to get there?
That's one thing that is so challenging about climbing a big mountain versus maybe a skiing. And you know, I did this ski expedition to in Antarctica. It was 600 miles on skis, dragging a 150-pound sled that was harnessed to my waist, 600 miles from the edge of the continent to the South Pole. And it was hard every day because Antarctica is the coldest, windiest place on Earth, right? Coldest temperatures ever recorded were recorded there. It is harsh, but it's pretty much the same harshness every day. So you get out there every day and you're moving toward your goal, right? You're gaining ground, you're moving toward the South Pole, and it's harsh every day, but you think, okay, I got through this today. I can do it tomorrow. I can do it the next day. The challenging thing about climbing a big mountain is that at the end of the day, you fall into your tent and you think, that was really effing hard. Like that, I barely made it here. Oh my gosh. But as you get higher on the mountain, it gets harder and harder and more uncomfortable, and your altitude headache increases, and you feel sick to your stomach, and you start to lose your appetite, and you feel weaker. As you make progress on Everest, you feel worse and worse and worse every day, and you know you're going to feel worse. And so there's, you know, that psychological aspect of it, of the more progress I make, the worse I'm going to feel. That is very hard to wrap your head around, but it's just something you have to accept. You have to understand that it's going to be uncomfortable almost the whole time that you're on the mountain, but that's temporary. At some point, you know, you're going to get off the mountain and things will feel a whole lot better. But for the time that you're on the mountain, you're pretty much going to be uncomfortable. And so you have to compartmentalize that discomfort and be able to look at the view and appreciate the other things that bring you joy in that discomfort, right? So there are a lot of things that you can find joy in on the mountain. So for example, the views, it's pretty incredible being up there and just looking out from where you are and just realizing you're in this incredible place, you know, that very few people have been. But the other thing I find that that I like to embrace in these situations is the opportunity to really, really bond with people on your team. Because when you are in a remote extreme environment, all emotions are heightened, right? So negative emotions are heightened as well as positive emotions. So when you feel discouraged, it's easy for your head to go to a very dark place. And that's when you really need to rely on your teammates, you know, to pull you out of that. And as a teammate and as a leader, you have to be very aware of where everybody else's head happens to be at that time. And do not make the mistake of thinking that just because somebody has been a strong performer, that they don't need a little encouragement and that they don't need to be reminded how important they are to the team. Because even the best, strongest, most accomplished climbers can have a really bad day on the mountain. And often a few kind words of encouragement or support can completely change the outcome of a situation for someone. And I would argue could even really be life-changing. You know, a pep talk can be life-changing for somebody. So that's what I have to keep in mind in these environments where things feel pretty ugly every day, is that there's always, you always have your team and your team can bring you out of that. And no matter how ugly the environment is, you can always put a smile on your face and share a few words of encouragement, and that can bring sunshine, you know, even during the worst storm.
Yeah, and one of the things that comes to mind is this end goal that you have in mind, and I want to I'll encapsulate it as risk and understanding how you get from A to Z in this case. But I'm thinking about, you mentioned the team, right? You have yourself that you prepare for. You kind of know, I would imagine somebody told you, you have this process of up and down, further up, down, further up, down. You clearly have equipment. You know, those watching this can see some of it behind, right? So technology. Yeah,
the technology, that's the technology.
You have your own brain. Can you, will you, do you want to deal with, that you mentioned? And so you can kind of plan and prepare for a lot of what that looks like.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean it's exactly how it will look when you get there. So how do you manage that as a participant, as a leader? Right. Do you rely on technology to help when something goes wrong physically and environmentally or whatever?
Right. So obviously you want to, you know, prepare as much as you can, right? Train, prepare, and you have a plan. And planning's great because planning, of course, keeps you organized, keeps you on track. So you have to have a good plan. But what you have to remember is that when you are in these environments where things are constantly shifting and changing, whatever plan you came up with, you know, last month, last week, this morning, your plan is outdated as soon as it's finished. Right? When you're in these environments that are constantly shifting and changing. So yes, it's important to plan, but you can't be hell bent on sticking to that plan no matter what. You have to be much more focused on executing based on what is going on at the time. So if you want to survive during extreme environments, when you're in these extreme environments, you have to be able to take action based on the situation at the time and not based on some plan. Right? So yes, plan, but you cannot be, you know, hell-bent on sticking to it. You've got to be able to pivot and take action based on what is going on at the time. Look, when I was the team captain for the first American Women's Everest expedition, we got to within 275 feet of the summit of Everest, and we had to turn back in bad weather because a storm came in at 6:30 in the morning, a freak storm, and we had subscribed to all the weather reports that all the teams subscribed to, and it showed that it was going to be a beautiful day, but a freak storm came in that nobody expected, and we were forced to abandon our summit attempt 275 feet from the top. So that is tough. I mean, abandoning your plan, something you've worked really hard for, something you've put a lot of effort into, it is hard to turn around and walk away from that. But with Mount Everest, you have to keep things in perspective because really that mountain is just a pile of rock and ice. It's really all it is, right? You can always go back. But if you do something dumb up there, if you make a bad decision, you may not have the opportunity to go back. So that's why you have to think about how every single move you make is going to affect everybody else around you and not just you. So it doesn't matter how much blood, sweat, and tears you personally put into something. The conditions aren't right, you know, you pull the plug and you walk away and you know that you can always come back another day.
So I would say, Teresa, I like the idea that we can do a connection here with the world of cybersecurity, right? Because our audience, obviously, it's focused on that. It's focused on technology and society and how everything in the end is interconnected. And what I hear from all that Alison said is that you need to be able to adapt to every situation. I mean, is the adaptation to go from camp one to camp two, camp one, camp, because you have to adapt your body, but you also have to adapt to any possible circumstance. And I feel like resilience is what comes in my mind. So there is, how can we connect this with our world?
Yeah, I mean, when Alison, you know, it was interesting. I remember the very first time I heard you tell the climb story. Yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, because I've never climbed a mountain like Everest, but I've done hiking with Dad and, you know, all that kind of stuff growing up. And I remember thinking, there are no shortcuts. Like, you can't just be dropped off at the top, look around and go, wow, that was cool. And then, you know, so like, for example, in North Carolina, where I live, there's Chimney Rock, which is in the movie, The Last of the Mohicans. And there's like a pretty, you know, nice, but long and challenging hike. Or you can take an elevator up. You know, so if you don't want to do The Last of the Mohicans trail, you can just like take an elevator up, see the view, take a picture, say I did the Chimney Rock. The way I would sort of link what Alison is talking about back to what we're all doing, there is no shortcut. Like, you can't just like plug in a firewall and endpoint protection and an incident and event monitoring platform and then sit behind it and say, I'm there, I'm at the top of the mountain and things look good. And so it's like that plan, it's the setbacks, it's the adapting to setbacks. You know, Alison, I think about, you know, if I remember about that first climb where you had to abandon that summit, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, some other teams went for it and didn't make adjustments. And I think it either created a big accident for them or there might have been lives lost. If I'm remembering, you've done so many amazing things, I don't want to like juxtapose the wrong story, but if I remember correctly, other people didn't take your sage advice and say, you know what, the mountain will be here when I come back. They actually trudged ahead.
There's people, so not on that same day, but what you just explained happens all the time. There are people that forget that the summit is not the goal. The summit is the halfway point, because you have to be able to get yourself all the way back down. So people die on the mountain, you know, every year, because, and typically most people die after they've reached the summit when they're on their way back down, because they use everything they've got left in them to get themselves to the tippy top, and then they don't have enough energy reserves to get themselves back down. And that's when people get into trouble. And that's why so many people collapse. You know, so many people, most people that die collapse shortly after they've reached the summit just below on their descent. So that's the problem too, is you really have to know what your goal is. And it might seem like, oh, the goal is getting to the top of the mountain. No. Number one goal, come back alive. Number two, come back with all your fingers and toes. Number three, come back as friends with the people that you're with. You know, number four, learn a lot of great lessons along the way. Goal, you know, getting to the top is maybe for me, goal number five, goal number six, it's way down there, you know, because if you don't come back from the mountain, what good is it to have reached the summit, right? Coming back's always the number one priority. So people die on the mountain every year because they're a little bit too ambitious, or they've not weighed the risk correctly, or they're for some reason thinking that standing on top of a pile of rock and ice is going to change, you know, their world. And I tell people all the time, you know, I went back to the mountain 8 years later after my first failed attempt, and I made it to the summit, and it didn't feel like it was that big of a deal. You know, once I got up there, I was like, oh, okay, here we are. You know, I'm standing on top of a pile of rock and ice, and it doesn't really feel any different standing here than it felt standing 275 feet below here, you know, where I stood in 2002 during the first attempt. And, you know, I really do believe that saying about it's the journey, it's not the destination, because it's about the lessons you learn along the way when you're fighting like hell to get up there that are really more important than just a few minutes standing on the very top.
And I'm gonna connect it back to what you just described, Teresa, sitting in front of a single pane of glass, I'll say, with the perfect security management environment, all the right tools, all the right team, and So you defined a goal of perfection, right? What is perfection? Is perfection getting to the top like you described, Allison, or is it all right. The other stuff that comes with it that collectively is perfection? And is there ever really a thing as perfection? And if we bring that back to security management, risk management, what is the goal? What's the definition of that? What does that goal really matter? And what's perfection? Should you really try to achieve perfection? Because if perfection is to get to the top, how long are you going to stay there? Just a few right. seconds, right? And then what? Then the rest of reality hits. And
yeah. So I have another analogy I want to share, and we talk about that. And I don't know, for people watching, I think you can probably see, I know people listening won't see this obviously, but for people watching, here's some photos of, this is an area called the Khumbu Icefall. And it is one of the most dangerous parts of the mountain. It's where most of the accidents occur on Mount Everest, because the Khumbu Icefall is basically 2,000 vertical feet of these big, huge moving ice chunks. And what happens is the sun comes up, everything starts to melt, and those ice chunks start to shift around, so you're in constant danger of being crushed. And then there are those big open crevasses, which is a big opening, you know, in the glacier where you could fall hundreds of feet to your death. So they span these rickety aluminum ladders across them, so you can get from one side to the other without falling in. And it's a really scary part of the mountain, but I always remind people, and for me, cyber stuff feels really scary. We hear about it all the time with our own, you know, personal information, with what's going on in the world and elections and hacking and whatever, you know. I read Manipulated, the book was so good, but it scared me too, right? So it feels scary. And the Khumbu Icefall is really freaking scary. Right? All these ladders and the crevasses and the big ice chunks that could crush you. But what I want people to keep in mind is that fear is just a normal human emotion. It's okay to feel fear. Complacency is what will kill you, right? Complacency is what puts you at risk. So when you think about the world of cyber, like, it can be scary. But it's okay. You know, fear is fine as long as it doesn't paralyze you. Fear is not going to do anything bad to you. Complacency is going to do you in every single time. You have to be able to act and react quickly when you're in these types of environments.
So let's talk a little bit about the concept of risk, because first of all, I think there is the why, which I always wonder why you decide to take this big risk. Mm-hmm. And of course you take it when you do this kind of adventure, you take big risk. So how do you measure risk and how do you deal with it? And how do you define risk in this situation? I mean, sometimes you're not in control.
A lot of times you're not in control. And so these, you know, in extremis environments, right, are these extreme environments where lives are on the line. So success is not measured, you know, they're different from normal environments, because success is not measured in terms of sales or profit or market share or anything like that. It's measured in terms of, you know, did your team come back alive? You know, did they come back healthy versus hurt? You know, so you look at these in extremis environments in a different way as far as how you measure success. And for me, risk, you know, there's always risk when you're in these environments that you cannot control. So first of all, keeping your head in a good space is important, right? People ask me, like, how are you not scared when you go to these places? I'm scared all the time when I go on these expeditions, all the time. But what I keep in mind is that you can be scared and brave at the same time. You can be scared and brave at the same time. And that's what I think allows you to keep moving forward in the face of fear. So, but with managing risk, just this is where it goes back to knowing, really truly knowing what your goal is, right? So when people, if you have the wrong goal, that I think increases the chances that something bad could happen, and really staying true to your values and true to your personal goals. So knowing that coming back alive is always the number one objective, I'm gonna make decisions based on coming back alive. So my decisions are very different from somebody whose goal is get to the top of the mountain no matter what, you know, must reach summit. You know, they're running out of oxygen. oxygen and energy. And they're just like, and the problem is they look at the summit and they think, okay, just 2 more hours and I can get there. In 2 more hours, I'll be there. I think I could keep going for 2 more hours. Well, okay, but can you keep going for 2 more hours and then another 8 or however long it's going to take you to get down? So that's what people forget. So I think that knowing what your true goal is will really help you figure out how to mitigate risk, right? And it affects the types of decisions that you make. So being aware of that, and like I said, like sometimes the true goal isn't that obvious. And you might, to you, it might be obvious, but it might not be to everybody on your team. And that's why it's really important to have team discussions all the time. It's really important to check in with everybody along the way, especially when things are difficult. You have to check in with people. People need to know that leaders care about them as a person, right? Not just as a team member that's doing something, but as a person. And I'll give you an example of that. In 2003, I was deputy finance director for Arnold Schwarzenegger during his bid to become governor of California. And it was an interesting election. It was a recall election when they were recalling the current governor and trying to, you know, put somebody else in his place. Arnold was one of many candidates running at the time. I remember very early on in the campaign, walking down the hallway, and he looked at me and he said, "How's our mountain climber doing today?" And I was so struck by that because I thought there's so many people working on this campaign. How does he even know that about me? And granted, at the time, he probably didn't even remember my name, but he took the time to learn about something that was important to me personally. Like, he took the time to get to know his staff as individuals, not as people working for him. So he didn't walk by me and say, "How's campaign finance going? Did you get Mark Cuban on the phone? Is he sending us a check? What's going on? Did you talk to, you know, this donor, that donor? Is our fundraiser all set for Friday?" That's not what he said to me when he walked by me in the hallway. He said, "How's our mountain climber doing?" And so to me, the fact that he took the time to ask me about something that was important to me that had nothing to do with my work for him, that is the kind of thing that creates trust and loyalty. That is the kind of thing that makes people want to work harder, that will help people feel confident walking into the face of the unknown, because that is what we are doing now. We are walking, or we are climbing into the unknown. We have zero visibility. We are climbing a mountain with zero visibility, right? And how do you get people to keep going and put one foot in front of the other? Make damn sure they know that you care about them and that you are there to back them up and that you're all walking up this mountain together into the storm.
It's incredible. And I want to go to you, Teresa, maybe draw on this a little bit more, because it's communication is a key part of that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one data element as you're analyzing the risk with every step you're taking. And there's the environmental risk the environmental data you can see for yourself. There's the data you get on your devices. There's the data in people's heads that you have to extract as a leader, perhaps, if they're not telling you. And Teresa, why I want to take this to you, there's potentially a lack of information, or no information, incomplete information, misinformation, and you, Allison, touched on it where you said you had all the feeds for the weather information, and yet you arrived to a point on the mountain where that didn't match, right? So either it was misinformation or not incomplete information. So Teresa, how, obviously your book is all about misinformation and a lot of things you're looking at. So how important is the data that you use, or the lack of data, in terms of making assumptions and making answering questions where you may not have all the information you need?
Well, I love, you know, kind of Allison relaying sort of these truly life lessons, right? I mean, think about this. So, because I think this is a really good mental image for everybody to have. Allison was talking about these massive sheets of ice that move. I mean, I don't know about you, but I visualize like a video game and you're trying to hop, maybe it's like Super Mario and you're trying to hop from the next and things are moving. I mean, so right. And so you have the information that you have with you. You then have things are moving all around you. So you have to make calculated decisions. And if you said, well, stop, wait, I got to have all the facts first. It's still moving and you're still on it on this rickety bridge. And so at some point you have to take the data, you have to take your experiences, you have to take the shifting environment around you, and then you have to make a decision. And a lack of a decision is going to be a decision to fall and to fail. And so I love what Allison was saying there, because it's like, it's a lot of times, and I think this is where CISOs really struggle and people in our industry really struggle, because we feel like, you know, like if you're a forensic expert or you're a log analysis expert or where you're like looking for the data to tell you something. Well, sometimes absence of data tells you something too. And you're just going to have to make the best decision you can, because the lack of a decision is a decision. And it could be fatal. In your case, it's data being stolen, but it could be critical systems actually being impacted because you didn't make a decision. I think the other thing that Allison was talking about there that translates really well to like getting information, what do you do with it, is communicating. So, you know, Allison had that information. She has to communicate to the team the decisions she's making as the leader of the team of, you know, whether it's we're gonna abandon going the extra hundreds of feet to get to the summit because our lives matter. You know, she could have had somebody on the team misinterpret the information and push back on her, right? So a lot of times to me, I think we're always waiting for like the data to give us sort of the magical answer, but it's a combination of things. It's asking the team for some input. But if you're the leader, you got to make the decision and go. What does the data tell you? But what do your experiences tell you? And then sometimes it's gut and judgment. And sometimes it's also a lot of good luck. You know, I always say to people like, you know, like at the White House, for example, we did a lot of work to make sure that we didn't have a data breach. And people are like, well, your team must have been really good. I'm like, they were really good. And you must have made good decisions. Yes, I did. And they're like, is there anything else? I'm like, yep, a lot of luck. A lot of luck. And anybody in cybersecurity that tells you that they're just the best at what they do and have all the best tools and all the best ideas and that's why, no, you also have to get lucky. And Allison, that first attempt, you were unlucky towards the end, but you made good decisions so that luck would be on your side the next time, right?
Exactly. It was, I mean, it really was just bad luck. That storm came in when we were there. I mean, it happens to teams and climbers all the time. I mean, even, you know, an avalanche, just there are all these things, you know, the glacier shifts or a ladder falls out of the Khumbu ice fall and somebody takes a fall. I mean, you're faced with bad luck on that mountain all the time. And, you know, like you're saying, you have to make decisions. You have to keep moving. You know, when I went back to the mountain 8 years after my initial attempt, and I remember being on the summit ridge, right? On the summit ridge, on my way to the top, I just passed the point where I had turned back 8 years prior. So I didn't know what was in front of me in terms of being familiar with the terrain. I had never been that far on the mountain. And I was on the summit ridge and it was, you know, an 8,000 foot drop on one side of the ridge and a 10,000 foot drop on the other side of the ridge. And visibility was horrible. We had a storm also that day. But what I realized is that I couldn't really see too far in front of me at all, but I realized that you don't have to have absolute clarity in order to just put one foot in front of the other. I don't have to see what's down the road in order to just take one step. Right? So that's what you have to do. You have to keep moving even when you feel like you don't have absolute clarity, because standing still and doing nothing and becoming complacent is what puts you at risk. And you're for sure never going to get anywhere if you don't take that step.
Yeah, you know, Alison, there is a lot of stories that obviously you come back from these adventures and you have. And I feel like when you say the people that aim to get there, but they don't think about coming back, and I know somebody's going to roll their eyes right now, but I'm going to mention when we went to the moon. And right, and Sean is rolling in eyes because I love that quote. Is that it was not just about going there, it was about bringing them back alive, yeah. Right? So yes. When you say all these examples, and then you're here telling this story after 7 summit, after all the adventure, the North Pole, the South Pole, and then you go, you write a book, and you have a documentary that you are the producer, The Glass Ceiling, you give us an opportunity to learn from your experience. And so we can learn from many other experience, because you know we love stories, we grow on stories. I always like to say humans are made of stories, so yeah. I'd like to hear from you, as we have unfortunately to close this conversation, about your role now in telling these stories as you're telling us, and how that fulfilled maybe your goal. I don't know, maybe that was the goal.
So I'm like you, Marco. I like stories. That's how I like to learn, when people share stories. And I think it's so important, you know, to, and often we hear all these success stories, but I think we can learn just as much from stories of failure when we don't achieve things. Look, I have a, yep. You know, if we had more time, I'd go into my South Pole expedition, where I became the first American to complete this route across West Antarctica to the South Pole. That sounds great. Oh, let's hear that story. Well, I don't have time to go into all the details, but the details was that I was the slowest, weakest person on my team, and my stronger teammates had to pull weight out of my sled to lighten my load so that I could keep up with everybody. So there's backstories to all these success stories. Have backstories,
well,
right?
You are invited to come back and tell that story.
I'll have to share that story because it was one of the toughest expeditions. 2 months in Antarctica, and once I got there, I realized quickly I couldn't do it. You know, you mentioned the documentary I'm working on, like the story that I think inspires me the most in life, that's affected me the most, is the story of this woman, Pasang Lamu Sherpa. And that's the documentary I'm working on, which is called The Glass Ceiling, is the story of her life. This woman was, she was a Sherpa, which is it's an ethnicity. People think Sherpa means carrying things up a mountain. Sherpa is actually an ethnic minority group in Nepal. And this woman, grew up in poverty. She couldn't read, she couldn't write. She couldn't even speak the national language because she never went to school. And Sherpas speak a different language than the rest of Nepal, than the normal Nepali language. But she had this dream to climb Mount Everest because she saw her father and her uncles and her brothers climbing, but the government of Nepal would not let female Sherpas climb. They would only let the men climb, and the women were very much discriminated against. And this woman who couldn't read or write or speak the right language in Nepal, she fought the government of Nepal for equal rights for all women over there, all women in Nepal. And she was finally granted access to the mountain. She tried 3 times initially and didn't make it to the summit. She never stopped trying, never lost that sense of determination. She went back a 4th time in April of 1993. She finally summited Mount Everest. It was her 4th attempt. She became the first Nepali woman to summit, right? This mountain in Nepal that was first climbed in 1953 wasn't climbed by a Nepali woman until 1993. And although she, you know, she summited the mountain, she was, you know, catapulted to hero status among the people of Nepal, but she died on the way down. So she never got to tell her story, and she left 3 young children behind. And I think it's such an important story because it really does prove that regardless of race, gender, socioeconomic background, you can change a country if you just have courage. That is the only thing this woman had going for her. Everything else was working against her. So Pasang Lamu Sherpa, to me, is one of the most courageous people that I've ever come across. So that's why I'm working on a film about her. And she just reminds me that it doesn't matter who you are, where you came from, your level of education, whatever it is, like, you can climb whatever mountain is in front of you if you just have courage.
Love it.
Phenomenal. And definitely look forward to seeing that documentary and experiencing that story. through you. And the name of your book as well, Allison, just so.
Oh, quick. It's called On the Edge, and I have my camera's mirrored, so it's backwards.
There you go.
No, we see it.
It's fine for us. It's mirrored for you. How's that?
Yeah, it's called On the Edge. That's actually a picture of me on the summit ridge on Mount McKinley. People think it's an illustration, but that's a photo of me right there.
Love it. Really love cool. It, love it. Really cool. We'll be sure to add a link to that.
Yep. Oh, thanks.
And check that out.
For sure, yeah.
And
everybody can hire her as a speaker. So then you can have as much time as you'd like with her, and you can hire her through Kepler Speakers.
Love that.
And if you need to borrow any gear, I have quite a supply here. If you're a women's size extra small, you're golden. Come talk to me.
Garage sale there. Love it.
Great.
Well, I mean, it feels awkward because I don't want to stop, but we're at the end. I think we can keep telling stories.
Thank you so much for having me. Teresa, Thank you for choosing me as your badass guest today. You're a badass yourself.
This was a badass.
I'm so honored concept. That you chose me as your podcast or webcast guest.
Yes, and with that, Teresa, we want to thank you as well, and maybe a final word from you as we wrap.
Sure. I hope everybody is as inspired by Allison's conversation with all of us today as I was. It never gets tiring, and I walk away with something new every conversation I have with Allison. And I just want to remind everybody that you're no good to anybody if you don't renew and recharge. So look for those opportunities to do that. And follow Allison's advice, right? So sometimes taking that step backward and renewing and recharging so that you can take a step forward is the path to success.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we thank you very much. And I really hope you come back and tell us the story.
I'd love to.
South Pole.
Part two.
I love stories. What can I do? All right. Thank you, everyone. We hope you enjoy it.
Very inspiring, very thought-provoking.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.